So imagine that you're going for a walk in the woods, and there's a path that you're following. And you don't know exactly sure where, you don't know where you're going, but you know you're supposed to be walking on this path. And then at some point, there's a fork in the path. And you realize that you have to make a choice. Either take the fork that goes to the right or the fork that goes to the left. But you don't know which fork to take. Or one fork has a big billboard on it, big advertisement says, take this one. A lot of your friends have taken it. It's well trodden. And the other one, the road not taken, right? Doesn't, you know, it's kind of small, humble, doesn't look like much. It's not like a big highway, just a little path. Not even sure where it goes. Anyway, there's two paths. And so you have to choose, and you choose one of the paths. And now you've made a big decision, because there's no going back, and that choice takes you in one direction. And you'll never know what the other path took. I was thinking about this earlier today when I thought of a series of events in my life. And I realized a lot of what's happened to me in the last 27 years, a lot of things that opened up for me, a lot of the directions I took in my life, and even, you know, what eventually led to me to this having this retreat center and teaching this retreat for you. I mean, there are many forks that came along, so not just one, but I thought, you know, wait, that person, she gave me a book about 1986 or 87. This person gave me a book. And that book led me to go move to Hawaii to study there, study Buddhist studies. And with that as a, with that path, all these other things began opening up for me. And here I am, from someone giving me a book. If she hadn't given me that book, I don't think I would have gone to Hawaii, and it would be a whole different life. And maybe some of you, maybe all of you have thought about this way, your life that way too, that, you know, you made a choice at some point, and you had other choices. You'll never know what those, you know, the other life that was waiting for you, if you made this other choice, what it would have been. And then now you've taken this path. And sometimes maybe you do know. Sometimes you know that was a mistake. You know, you chose a path and you do your reflection about, well, where did I make that choice that took me off in that direction? And you're thinking about that while you're in jail. You know, oh, yeah, I think that if I hadn't made that choice, I don't think I would have ended up, you know, in that direction. So all kinds of things. So in this sutta that we're reading, there are, in a sense, two paths being offered. The path of the Brahmin is to go bathe in the river. And the path of the Buddha is to do the inner bathing. So the path is either to focus on the external world as the answer, or find some answer within. And not so many of us here, I think, are so focused on a river, literally being the place to go have all our answers, all our questions answered, all our issues resolved. But we, you know, in our modern world, we have our own external rivers we go to. So we have, you know, one of the common ones has to be with, you know, maybe a relationship. If I just get that right relationship, then, you know, everything will be okay. Or the right job, or the right house, or I should have been given someone else's bank account. And then everything would be okay. Or it could be if I can only get revenge. If I can only let people know, you know, that get their apology or something, some external thing that we want. Not that all these things are wrong to pursue, but if we put all our eggs in those baskets, if we think that that's finally going to solve my life, it might be a little bit like the Brahmin who goes to the river. That can't be the ultimate answer. You don't know what that... And so the other path is the path that goes within, looks within. What's inside of you? One of the nice things about finding the answer within is that you're portable. And you get, you know, once you find the answer within, you can take yourself anywhere and there it is. If the answer is in a river, you can't, you know, the river is not very portable. So then you have to go back to the river. If the answer is in something in the world, then you're kind of tied to that thing being some way. But if the answer is within, then you find that answer anywhere you can go because you carry it with you. So then, so the Buddha then focuses on the inner. And if you look at the inner life, then there's a dichotomy or two different paths you can take. And one path is represented by taking these 16 attitudes, emotions, ways of behaving that come out of that have to do with our relationship to others, how we relate. So contempt and anger and conceit and avarice and covetousness, variety of things. If we can take that path, we can get involved in those, or we can take a different path. And one kind of maybe naive idea of the other path is, well, if that's the path of how we're supposed to relate to people, about, you know, relating in ways that are not so good, let's not relate. Let's go into the forest, let's go into the cave and just be a hermit, and let's kind of be aloof and distinct and not have any relationships, you know. After all, you know, this Buddhism thing is all about having no desire, right? So if you have no desire, you might as well just not exist. It's not possible to have no desire. Desire comes with being, we're human desire links. So desire is a very important part of human life and a valuable part of human life. But we just have to know how to negotiate the world of desire. But some people come to Buddhism and they kind of pull back so far. Things all about renouncing, letting go so thoroughly that they become almost like non-human because there's no relationship there, no connection to others in that. So I don't think that's what the Buddha is saying, because in the talk that Andrea gave yesterday, she talked about having confidence or trust, perfect confidence, perfect trust in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And this idea of trust or confidence, the word pasada is a beautiful word. Some people translate it as faith, confidence, or trust. But the word also means serene or clear, like the sky is clear, the glass is clear, the stream is clear. So the clear, serene. So some people define it as serene faith. So it's not like, you know, passionate bhakti kind of devotion. There's something that's very tranquil about it. But that, whatever that is, that trust or faith or confidence, happens in relationship to something other than yourself, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And so So there's a different kind of social relationship, social emotion. And I think the sutta that we're reading alternates and goes through different kinds of social or interpersonal feelings or attitudes that we can have as part of what to negotiate. It talks about the 16 imperfections of the mind, and then it talks about this trust or this confidence. And then we'll get tomorrow, it talks about the Brahmaviharas, having love for the world around you. And that's an attitude to have, it's a healthy one. So there's a fork between those relationships we have, those ways we relate to the world around us, to others, that one leads to one direction, one leads to the other. One leads to probably to unhealthy social relationships, unhealthy kind of relationships in the world. and one leads to healthy ones, and we come to a fork in the road, and which do we choose? There is some sooner or later you'll come to a fork. Maybe not today, but you'll come to a place you have to choose between different things. One person today said that that he hadn't noticed yet that all these imperfections of the mind had been eradicated, abandoned totally, but the important movement was he no longer believed them. And that's quite something, not to believe them, because usually we get fully sucked into the world because we believe they're right, they're beneficial, they're justified, they're valuable, we believe they have authority, that's how things are. But it's a big step to come to a fork and say, well, either I believe this or I don't believe this. Now I no longer believe it. And then that can make all the difference, since we don't quite so wedded to them or committed to them. So at some point becomes this, what river do we swim in? What river do we enter into in the inner life? There was a story that I heard many years ago it was presented as a Native American story of a grandfather who said something like, there are two wolves inside of me that are fighting. A wolf that wants to harm and a wolf that wants to bring peace. And the grandson says, well, which wolf is winning? And the grandfather says, whichever one I feed. So we have these different forces within us. In Buddhist terminology, we might say we have a Buddha nature and we have a Mara nature. Which one's going to win? Which one's going to get dominance? Depends which one we feed, which one we get involved in. And I like this idea of saying we have both. Sometimes you find Buddhism tremendous emphasis on the Buddha nature theory, as if that's the end of the story. We have this innate, beautiful nature. It could be, but I'd like to think just as much as we have a Buddha nature, we have a Mara nature. That's also kind of deeply seated in the human consciousness. So which one wins? Which one dominates? Which path do we take for our lives? It's an important thing to consider, and what choice we make. So even coming on retreat here is a choice to come on retreat. And I don't think the choice to come on retreat is so you can get better at greed, hate, and delusion. I really need to get into my hate and my contempt of the world. And I've heard that if I really kind of, come to IRC, that's a good place to really work on it. And they mostly leave you alone. And I don't think that's what people do when they come here. They come usually with some sense that there's a path to take that brings out what's best in them. For me, as teachers, it's really remarkable to be a teacher, especially a retreat teacher, because we really get to see some of the best in people. And one of the reasons is that I see this on retreats, we see this on retreats, is that the practice is to really pay attention to what's happening here with you, the cost of your behavior, your thinking, what's going on. And things that take a lot of work are tiring and contracting and painful to be involved in. It's just like, you don't want to be caught in those. It's not good to be caught. It just feels that way. It doesn't feel right to be caught up. You lose your autonomy, your freedom when you're caught in something. And the kind of unhealthy attitudes of mind, the unhealthy things that get us in trouble, that take a lot of work to maintain. The mind is agitated, there's contraction, we're caught up. And so there's often a movement here in retreat, how not to get caught? What does it take not to be caught by this? The good qualities of mind, the Buddha nature, things like loving kindness, there could be a lot of work to do, but there's also a way in which they can arise much more naturally. They don't take a lot of work. They can arise out of a serene mind or a calm mind. And so it feels good. It doesn't feel like there's a problem. It's not because we're caught in something. So this movement to go from not being caught to being caught, from being caught to being not caught, tends to bring out the best in people. It tends to lessen, I don't want to say the worst in people, but I guess that's what's implied. It tends to, lessen, the more unhealthy things that we might be involved in. And I like this idea of the healthy and the unhealthy. We come to a path. There's a path. There's two different directions, that which is healthy and that which is unhealthy. Because these choices we make, or the things we get involved in, have consequences. So, for the purpose of this talk, I'd like to use the example of you can have a cut in your finger, say. You've cut yourself. And what you do with that cut sets in motion different things. There's two different paths that can arise, depending what you do with that cut. If you take that cut and you go and get the most dirty dirt in the garden, I mean, even better, the sewage. We have a septic system here. And you rub it into the wound, that's going to set in motion a certain unfolding, that's going to set something in motion. And you don't have to will it or want it or even, you know, it's just like if you just leave that alone, it'll set in motion certain, probably you don't want to think about it. And it's not going to look pretty. But if you keep the wound clean and maybe cover it with a bandage, that allows some other thing to happen. You don't have to, you don't have to be the engineer that figures out how that wound's going to heal itself. There's a tremendous inner physiological resource that's available. It's probably an amazingly complex physiological event to send all the chemicals and all the proteins and all the nutrients and all that everything that needs to happen for the body to figure out how to heal that cut. But it's kind of effortless in terms of what we have to do. All we have to do is keep it clean, and this very complex thing happens. There's this inner healing force that the system knows how to heal if you keep it clean. The universe is built in such a way, nature is built in such a way, that if you put sewage in that cut, the appropriate things will happen. Those wonderful bacteria that live in that sewage, they know what to do, and they know, they're happy. Wow, look at us. We got this wonderful environment to grow and grow and grow and grow. And you know, they're happy. They do their natural thing. But, you know, by the time you get to the doctor and they say, well, you have gangrene, I think we have to cut it off. That's a whole natural process itself. So what I'm trying to say here is that there are these natural processes that send in motion. And it isn't just simple. So if you choose the imperfections of the mind and act on those and get involved in those and choose those, that sets in motion things, unseen consequences, emotions and movements in our lives. If we choose serenity, clarity, peace, cleanliness, if we choose something else, it sets other forces in motion in our mind. And I would like to say that for many of us who have wounds, something comparable to the cut, it heals it. It allows for the inner forces to heal. There's tremendous forces within us of psychological healing that are waiting to occur if they're given the chance, if they're given the space. And some of you, I think, have already seen that in these few days of the retreat, that there's a fair chance that some of you have noticed that you're less tense than you were a few days ago. Maybe your shoulders are relaxed. Maybe you're not carrying as much tension as you were before. Maybe the first day your mind was quite agitated, and now you're less agitated. There's a settling and relaxing that goes on. Sometimes on a retreat, there's a releasing of long-held memories or long-held emotions that have been festering under the surface, but finally they get a chance to come into the sun, come out in the open. And then the heart, you know, if you get out of the way, just allow for them, it's phenomenal how much our emotional life will heal and move towards health, or move in the natural way it's supposed to move. If mostly we get out of the way, just get out of the way. And get out of the way means that we don't attack it, we don't upset with it, we don't get bothered by it, we don't judge it, and we don't judge ourselves, and we also don't participate in it. No self-pity, no getting involved with the story and ruminating over and over again and recreating it. But make space for this to be. And it's remarkable what can start happening in the heart, the healing and the force that goes on. I like to say it this way, that your heart knows better what you need than you do. So if you're always kind of in charge up in the control tower of what you think you need and judging what needs to happen, it doesn't really maybe allow the heart a chance to unfold in the way it needs to unfold. To say it a different way, the Dharma knows better what you need than you do, than what's in, you know, the control person in the control tower. And so there's a trusting of the Dharma, trusting what's going to unfold here that goes on. So this inner rivers that we can bathe in, you have some choice, some degree of choice, whether you bathe in the river of the imperfections of the mind, or you bathe in some other kind of river. And what's, I think, very, as Andrea said, what's very important here, the turning point for this sutta, is when you've gotten to know these imperfections well enough that you begin to distance yourself from them. You no longer believe them, or they lessen, or sometimes they actually disappear. Maybe finally able to let go of some of them, no longer involved in them. There comes to the mind a relief. There comes to a mind the experience, the beneficial experience of having a mind that's not caught in those things. And the absence of that, especially if you've had it for a long time and you felt the cost of it, the absence of that feels really good. There's a lightening, an opening, a clearing, a freedom, something. And not only does it feel good, but it's very, very encouraging to realize that what I've been stuck with for years, the kind of attitudes that I've been carrying with me that have been painful to carry, that keep revisiting, that they're not built into the hardware of my being. It's not like I'm born that way and I have to always be this way. But there are these things that are part of the software, and the software can be changed. The software can heal. The software can be different. And that's very, very encouraging. And that encouragement and that experience of your own freedom, their own clarity, their own healing that can happen, is pointed to in the sutta as the reference point to understand who the Buddha is. The Buddha isn't some supernatural dude who's, you know, lived a long ago, but the Buddha represents someone who has done this inner work in a profound way that serves as an example of what is possible. But it isn't because you've read a book and you believe, oh, this guy is really hot. But now you know, if this is what I experienced, I know this is possible. Now I think I get a sense that this guy, this Buddha guy, he's just done it much better than I have, much more thorough. And this is really inspiring for me. And the Dharma is the way to do this. The Dharma knows. The Dharma means many things, but one of the things it means is the natural processes that exist. And if you give the Dharma, the natural processes, half a chance, they'll move you towards health, psychological health, they'll move you to wholeness, they'll move you to healing, they'll move you towards freedom. I think there's a strong desire in our system for freedom, for liberation, that we should trust. I call it a biological imperative. Independent of your control tower wanting things, the heart wants to be free. And the Dharma is just the natural process of moving towards freedom. Or it's also the natural process of moving towards sickness or decay if you follow the imperfections of the mind. The Dharma is just a natural process. But to be inspired in that Dharma, the natural process that the Buddha was teaching and pointing to, that which comes from ethics, that which comes from practicing honesty and truthfulness, practicing mindfulness. And then the Sangha. So this is what we talked about yesterday. So then the sutta goes on and say, when you have this confidence or this trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, or if you prefer, this trust in this movement towards freedom, this trust in taking a different path, then the heart, the mind, and the sutta uses the word, gains inspiration. In, I think Bhikkhu Bodhi translated it as inspiration in the meaning. He said, yeah, in the meaning. The word they translate as meaning can also be translated as the goal, or translated as what is beneficial. So one gains an inspiration in the meaning, and gains an inspiration in the Dharma. So it says, first it goes, those who have this unshakable confidence in the Buddha gain inspiration in the meaning and inspiration in the Dharma. Those have unshakable confidence in the Dharma, they say Buddha first, Buddha, then the Dharma, gain inspiration in the meaning and inspiration in the Dharma. Those who have unshakable confidence in the Sangha gain inspiration in the meaning and inspiration in the Dharma. It always comes back to the Dharma each time. The Dharma is the practice. The Dharma is the path that we walk. So inspiration in the practice. So the word inspiration is an interesting word. And here again, it's an emotion or an attitude in relationship to something. And now it's in relationship to the goal of practice, the meaning of practice, the purpose of practice, and in the Dharma, the practice that leads that. So this is a very important word in this sutta. It's a kind of a turning point word. So now I'd like to step back a little bit to the beginning, where this Brahman, he bathes in the external river. The Buddha bathes in this inner bathing. And this play of these two different kind of choices also plays itself out, I believe, in some of the words that are being used in the text. That a Brahman is someone who adheres to what's called the triple Vedas, the three Vedas, the Vedic literature. Brahmins are the carriers of the Vedic literature. And the word Veda, the three the Vedic literature, the Vedic religion, Veda means to know, the three knowledges. And the Brahmins were the carriers of this knowledge. They memorized the ancient texts. And to this day, for thousands of years in India, from father to son, they have passed on the oral tradition of memorizing these ancient texts. And so the knowledge of the Vedas is a knowledge that comes from the outside, externally, and one has memorized it. So Vedas are very important for this. The word for inspiration, that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates inspiration, is the same word. It's Veda. And because the word to know, knowledge here, has a number of secondary meanings. And one of the meanings, it means, the Vedas, these ancient texts, are the religious texts, it's the religious knowledge. This word here, Veda, means, it also is closely connected to the word to feel. Vedana, you know the word Vedana, same word, same source. And one of the meanings of Veda here in the Buddhist text, it's a religious feeling. And it's a religious feeling which is connected to joy. So Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as inspiration. But when you have this confidence in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, then comes joy. Joy in the meaning, joy in the Dharma. Joy is an important part of this. It's a turning point in the Dharma practice. And to allow ourselves to feel joy, I think it's probably a healthy thing, appropriate thing, when we teach the Dharma, to point all of us to the possibility of having some joy. Don't overdo it. And don't, go around and pretend you're joyful. There's saccharine joy. Please don't do that. When I practiced Buddhism for decades, 20 years probably, before I had any sense that it was okay to experience joy. I can remember that I actually tried to avoid experiencing joy because I thought somehow it was kind of shallow. And that didn't work. Avoiding it didn't work. But the but I think that to hear that that it's appropriate to call upon joy or to avail yourself of it, and maybe there are ways in which it's relatively easily accessible. It doesn't have to be dramatic joy. You don't have to go around, you know, skipping and singing. But what is there anything about this Dharma practice that you're involved in that brings you joy or sense of inspiration or delight? More importantly, from the point of view of the sutta, have you had any experience in your life or in your Dharma life so far that gives you some encouragement that shows you, yes, something is possible? And does it give you some sense of inspiration or joy? Yes, it's possible. Maybe it happened 10 years ago, and even then, even back then I had something, I experienced something. I was caught, and then I was not caught anymore. I was afraid, and then I was no longer afraid. I was filled with hate, and then my hate went away. There was one woman who came to a number of retreats with me, and she came back at the following year, and she said, at the last retreat, I stopped being cynical. As long as I can remember, I was always cynical. At that last retreat, I haven't been cynical for a year. Isn't that remarkable? I was very inspired by that. Wow. What a change for her. For me, in my early years of practice, I was very inspired and felt a certain kind of joy from being around other practitioners. I could see the beauty or the value or the freedom or the presence in other practitioners. There was a lot of qualities I saw in other practitioners that I admired. They were such an odd lot that they all had different qualities. You know, some of them had certain good qualities, and so I would kind of like remember appreciating, oh, that person has that quality. Wow. And I could feel it came out of their practice. I remember I was the Eno at Green Gulch. Not Eno, but I was the person who invited people to give Dharma talks at the Green Gulch Zen Center, and invited one of the senior students of Suzuki Roshi to come and give a talk, someone who didn't live at Zen Center, a teacher, and I didn't know him, and I wasn't particularly inspired by what he had to teach. But what I felt from him, the quality that inspired me and made me so glad to know him, was I could feel, by that time it was probably 25 years, of sincere intention to practice the Dharma. I could feel in his being, how he was, how he carried himself, the sincere intention to practice. And I was so inspired by that, from that person. So to feel some joy, is it possible? Is it possible to be open to it? Is it possible to maybe not to make yourself joyful, but what does it take to kind of open to allow it to be there, to feel it, to be present for it? It was hard for me to feel joy because I had all these very important, well-developed policies about life that I lived by. And one of the policies was that whatever was going on with me was always wrong. Whatever was happening here, whatever I was thinking or feeling or doing, was wrong. And as I've said to some of you, I used to think that gil was short for guilt, because I could be guilty for anything. Literally, I started getting kind of amazed how easy it was for me to feel guilt. When I started feeling guilt, guilty just walking across the meditation hall floor or opening a door, I felt guilty. I mean, can you believe it? So I had these good, really good policies going. That was, if you have policies, it's good to be thorough, right? So I had them down. Or then another policy was that, the grass is always greener somewhere else. So not only was this wrong here, but somewhere else was better. So, you know, they had all these things going on. And those things interfered with my ability to feel joy, because I couldn't really relax and just be present for this, because this was wrong. So how could you feel joy if this is wrong? And so the kind of dharmic joy that I've now come to cherish, I had to sneak up on me. I had to kind of like enter through the back door, because I wasn't going to. And I, you know, lo and behold, I was sitting there quiet, minding my own business, and maybe somehow or other the breath, my breathing distracted me enough from my, somehow, from my thinking, to give enough time and space for something else to enter into. And I say it that way because I don't want to give credit. It just, you know, just somehow I got distracted by my breath. Isn't that nice? No. I wish that on you. So there's this turning point with the joy, and it doesn't have to. Maybe the word is gladness or delight, something that feels good. Maybe joy is too big of a word. So here it goes. So I'll read this. It says. So when one has given up, and then has this magical word, or special word, that no one knows quite how to translate. So there's a footnote and all that for it to explain how we don't really know. The Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as in part. When one has given up in part these imperfections of the mind. Isn't that kind of helpful? Phew, I don't have to do it entirely. In part. When one gives up in part these imperfections of the mind, one considers, one takes the time to reflect, I have confidence in the Buddha. And here it's unwavering. Elsewhere, Bhikkhu Bodhi translated different ways at different times, different editions of the book. And actually, remember the Veda, the word to know, is kind of an important word. The literal meaning of the word he translates as unwavering or perfect is based on knowledge. So this is points back to the idea of first-hand experience of having let go of something or released something or lightened something. So you know from your own experience something, and that's what gives birth to this confidence. So the dictionary I have at home says this word means, this whole expression means, should be translated as trust based on knowledge. So having given up in part the imperfections of the mind, one considers, I have trust based on first-hand knowledge. I have trust in the Buddha. Having this trust in the Buddha, one gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, one gains gladness connected to the Dhamma. When one is glad, so remember that there's a natural unfolding of things. There's a Dharma that's operating. When you don't have to be in charge from the control tower of everything that's supposed to happen to you, you can allow certain, part of the reason to relax and open up and allow things to be in a wise way, is to begin allowing the Dharma to operate through you, to allow the natural things to unfold within you. Just like you want to allow the cut to have the body to have the optimal conditions to do its own work in healing the cut, you want to allow the heart to have its optimal conditions that it can do its work, to unfold, to let the Buddha nature unfold, to let the path that unfolds, this, when you enter the river. Maybe let's change the analogy from path to river. When you enter that, there's a fork in the river. And if you take one river, it carries you in a certain direction. It unfolds. And here's a description of this, of how the river flows, what unfolds. When one is glad, here it's translated rapture is born. That's too high a hope. So I like it's the word is piti, so P-I-T-I in Pali. So I'd like to translate that as joy. When one is glad, joy is born in oneself. In one who is joyful, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels, here he translated as pleasure, I like to translate the word sukha as happy. One whose body is tranquil, one feels happy. And one who feels happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is a passive process being described here. It doesn't say, get yourself glad. Once you're glad, get yourself joyful, really work on it. Once you're joyful, relax. And once you're relaxed, be sure to be happy. And then get yourself concentrated. You know, like just huff and puff, really get it going. But rather, it's a very peaceful, natural process being described. And this particular natural process is talked about repeatedly in the suttas. It's always based on some joy. And in a different discourse, it talks about having joy that the hindrances are no longer operating, the five hindrances. So that's, you know, so just because something, when the hindrances or some obstacle in the mind, difficulty in the mind disappears, don't just go on to the next thing. And take your time to appreciate that. Oh, that feels good. Wow, it's nice. I've been struggling all morning on the retreat. My mind's so difficult. I don't know what happened, but I went to lunch. After lunch, I went and got a cup of tea, and I went and sat on the deck in a nice chair, and I felt happy and peaceful. It wasn't, my troubles were no longer there. Oh, well, but in 5 minutes, I'm going back to sit, and I'm sure it's going to be, it's going to be awful again, and why did I come? Oh, I love this story. I'll tell you the story that I'm sorry if you've heard it too many times before, but many years ago, I was teaching a retreat, and there was a woman who I knew who, from a number of retreats, who was very troubled, very, very troubled. A lot of inner conflict, outer conflict, always inner thinking, figuring it all out, kind of lost in her thoughts, kind of, you know, it was difficult to be a teacher with her because it was all in the past and her thoughts and working things out. And at that retreat center, we had this, Santa Sabina, we had this, one morning, it was middle of the retreat, it was kind of like magic. The morning light came into the windows of all these glass windows in the meditation hall, and it was just like it was November. It was beautiful, clear, sunny day. This beautiful light coming in, and it just felt like everything got so still in that hall. So I was so still. It was like a reverent time. It was so beautiful. And as it turned out, right after that sitting, I had to go to my interview room to have an offer my interviews. And she was the first person. She came in and took the seat opposite me, and she was completely peaceful. She was in the same state. It was contagious. I'd never seen her that way. She was peaceful. She was like, she was light, just like light was coming in through the window. She was this light, being of light, peaceful, and it was so beautiful to sit there and watch her. So I don't know how it unfolded. But maybe there was some discussion about how good she felt, how wonderful it was at that moment. It was great. And then she said, yes, but yesterday it was awful and I was struggling with this thing. And as I watched her start talking about the story of yesterday, she transformed into this deeply troubled person. Why? Why bring yesterday into today? Who needed yesterday? Let yesterday go. It was so sad to watch. So you're sitting there at the deck, you know, you've had trouble all morning, you're having your tea, things are peaceful and content, and nothing, no problem in the world at all. Enjoy it. Let that joy, let that simple joy be nourishing for you. If even for 5 minutes it comes. So it's nourishing, it's allowing for this to be there. We can't expect to always be joyful. One of the Dharma joys that I have, one of the great Dharma joys, is when you're really miserable. Choose your misery. When you're really miserable and you know you have a practice, you have the Dharma. And I've been sometimes feel awful and had a certain kind of joy. Well, I get to practice. I have a practice that can address this, that can meet this. And it buoys me, it inspires me. Even though in a general way, if you ask me how I was, I'm saying I'm miserable. Isn't that nice to have that joy, Dharma joy? So that's one of my hopes for people to practice, is that they develop some Dharma joy, and knowing that they have a practice, knowing that they're connected to the Dharma, knowing there's a path that they can walk. So this process here is a natural process that happens to us rather than something that we construct and make happen. And this is why it's very important in Dharma practice to learn how to let go of kind of this, you know, excessive self-centered controlling of our experience. It's important to let go of trying too hard to make something happen, to be in charge, as if you know what's supposed to happen. This is a retreat where I'm supposed to get into the third jhana and have all that happiness. This is it. You know, I'm going to really huff and puff. That's the control tower, right? Your heart says to you, no, no, no. This is the retreat where you're supposed to cry for 7 days. And then the two of them fight, right? But maybe the heart knows best. Right, and crying is actually a very important thing to do. So, you know, who knows what's supposed to happen? So there has to be some allowing, some opening. And I've cried on retreat, and it felt right. It felt, what a relief to let this come. Again, a kind of a joy, a kind of a inspiration, or a kind of a sense of rightness. Oh, finally, it's coming. So one of the things important to do in Dharma practice is, in just the right way, to learn how also not to always be engineering your practice and controlling it and expecting it and measuring it, what's supposed to be happening, but to give some room for the heart to unfold on its own. Give some room for the Dharma to have a chance to move through you. Give some chance for the natural process to work, but your job is to avoid putting the sewage in the wound. And instead, the best you can, keep the wound clean. And you have some choice in that matter. You have some choice in the matter. So then, so this is repeated in the suttas a number of places, this idea, this pattern. If you go from gladness to joy to a tranquil body to happiness and to concentration. And here, concentration does not come from huffing and puffing. Concentration comes from some modicum of well-being, some modicum of being relaxed. So important, you know, I think almost like Andrea almost opened the retreat up with the first instructions with relax. She would say that repeatedly. So important. Because the relaxation allows for such natural process, the healthy process, Dharma process, to unfold. Tension does not. What makes your heart sing? What makes you happy? What helps you sit quietly with yourself, and so that your heart sings, your heart's at home, your heart's at peace in itself, there's a sense of well-being? Is there such things? Maybe there isn't yet. But maybe then your confidence is borrowed. Maybe your joy is borrowed because you see in other people they followed a path. You see other people who have lived this life, who've come to the other side and discovered some freedom or peace or ease or something. And it's okay for your joy to be borrowed, your inspiration to be borrowed. As long as you understand it's a way station as you find your own way to your own. So this natural process, gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and then concentration. And one of my strong feelings about meditation practice is that I am not responsible. Well, I say it, let's be careful how I say it. I can't make myself concentrated. All I can do is create the conditions for it. And when the conditions are right, the Dharma knows. The Dharma kind of, at some point, concentration happens. And I've suffered a lot from trying to be the one who got concentrated. But I have to do my part, but I no longer try to become concentrated. I just try to put the conditions in place. I try to be quiet, I try to let go a lot of best I can of my thoughts. I try to be present for my breath. I try to be relaxed. I try to be allowing enough to allow something to happen. I try to have some modicum of well-being as I sit here, to be content, to be settled, to be here. And then at some point, as I keep coming back here and be here, and this something begins unfolding, begins moving in me. And then at some point I recognize that now I'm concentrated. So where do you look? Do you look externally for the answers of your life, or you look internally? As we look internally, what do we find there? What are the forks we're in there? What do you choose to follow? What do you choose to act on unskillful states, or do you choose not to act on them, choose to let go of them? Can you find the stream of joy and inspiration and confidence and trust, even if it's just a very little trickle of a creek at first? And then over time it can get stronger, bigger. And then as we enter the stream of the Dharma, at some point, there's a deeper settling that happens, an opening, a relaxing. And the heart begins to flow. The heart begins to sing or to speak or to resonate, or the heart begins to... The old language that I used to use was the heart would open. The practice would... I used to call mindfulness the tenderizer of the heart. And all the hard crust and that, you know, my heart would slowly begin to wear off and dissolve. And as the crust began to wear off, and the heart became open and sensitive. And what happens when the heart becomes open, the heart becomes sensitive, when the crust and the armor falls away? When we are willing to have an open heart, unguarded heart. It's one of the great things of Dharma practice, is that it gives us the foundation and the wisdom to have an unguarded heart. Not guarded with the iron armor. Instead, it's guarded by ethics, sila, for example, and truthfulness. What happens next in the sutta is, as in whatever the samadhi, word samadhi, concentrated means, what happens next is love. The brahma-viharas, loving-kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and a certain kind of love called equanimity. And this has been my experience, is that as I practiced, that to my surprise, without any design on my part, because I didn't know it was part of the practice really, was that my heart started to glow, first with compassion, as with my Zen practice, compassion began to arise and grow. And then with my vipassana practice, loving kindness began to arise and glow. And I knew it wasn't my doing, because when the teachers try to do the loving kindness meditation, they do guided loving kindness meditation in the hall, I stop going to the hall. You forget this. This is too sentimental and too artificial, and I was not going to be part of any of that stuff. That kind of, you know, I was a Zen student. I'm not going to get involved in that kind of fluffy stuff. So I would avoid the hall when they gave the guided loving kindness meditation, and lo and behold, again through the back door, right? I started feeling all this loving kindness, this metta, and I couldn't believe it. It felt so good, and it felt so integral and right, and it just arose. And now we're back with the Brahmaviharas with a relational attitude and emotion. Remember, this sutta is very relational. It's very much about our relationship in the world. And it goes back and forth between how we relate to the other people in our lives and how we get to know what's inside of ourselves. And it goes in and out, back and forth. And so the next step, which Andrea will talk about tomorrow, is the Brahmaviharas. Aren't we lucky? So I know that I was very depressing when I gave my talk 2 days ago. You know, the imperfections of the mind and all these things. And I mean, the first day of the retreat, to start that way, what a bad news. Luckily, you guys stayed. And so now we're getting into the good stuff, joy and all that. And Andrea will do love. Lucky her. Lucky you. So stay tuned. So let's recollect ourselves.